Respected guests, friends, young people, and brothers and sisters. About 3 years ago, which was also about 3 years into the second Iraq War, the United States could barely find a friend on the world stage, apart from Britain, who would support them in their Middle Eastern policies, or for that matter, in much else. The U.S. occupation of Iraq was regarded in nearly all the developed nations of the world as warmongering. In this country, it was routinely said that the policies of the United States had become an embarrassment to the U.S. population, and an embarrassment all over the world due to the firm and inflexible stance taken by President George Bush. But in the last few years, a remarkable transformation has occurred. Two of the United States' strongest and most powerful critics, Germany and France, have undergone a remarkable transformation. The voters of both of those nations rejected governmental leaders hostile to the United States and replaced them with individuals anxious to befriend the U.S. and their policies. First, nearing the end of 2005, Germany replaced the hostile Gerhard Schröder with a far friendlier Angela Merkel, and relations between the two countries are on their best footing in quite some time. In France, Jacques Chirac finished his five-year term, and the French people were given a clear choice between Chirac's hand-chosen successor and a violently anti-American woman, Ségolène Royal, and her opponent, an openly pro-U.S. Nicolas Sarkozy. Sarkozy won the election going away. And the longer the campaign went, the wider Sarkozy's lead. Now, what has been the reason for this great sea change? 3 years ago, America was not only the great Satan to the Islamic nations, but to listen to their rhetoric, even to the modern European ones. And what has changed? Clearly, it hasn't been any change in policy in the United States. If anything, the U.S. has actually stepped up its aggression in Iraq. So what in the world has changed in the last few years? Perhaps we can see this most clearly in the address given to the French people by Nicolas Sarkozy in his first national election, following his first national election to France. Wynette reported on his speech this way. Sarkozy criticized Russia for its dealings on the international stage. Russia is imposing its return on the world scene by using its assets, notably oil and gas, with a certain brutality, he said. When one is a great power, one should not be brutal. Energy disputes between Russia and neighbors such as Belarus and Ukraine have raised doubts in Europe about Moscow's reliability as a gas exporter. It supplies Europe via its neighbors with around a quarter of its gas demands. Sarkozy, though, had warm words for the United States, saying friendship between the two countries was important. It's not very hard to see what the difference is between now and a mere 3 years ago. The difference is the growing strength of Russia. Russia, 3 years ago, was a poor, bumbling nation. They were trying to find their direction as a nation. Oil revenues were high, but they were controlled by private businessmen who were siphoning off national product. As Putin gained more and more control over the Russian economy, he began jailing those Russian businessmen involved in oil and nationalizing their resources. British Petroleum was hired as a company to come in and show Russia how to get more oil out of fields Russia believed had been depleted, using simple modern techniques unfamiliar to Russia. A Wall Street Journal article a few years ago stated that just by updating the techniques of oil recovery in known fields, that is, without any new discoveries whatsoever, Russia had as much oil in reserve as Saudi Arabia. And now all that money and wealth with the high price of oil is going to Russia, the state. And Russia, rather than share her wealth with her population, is using that money again to rebuild her once formidable military. During the Ronald Reagan presidencies, during what was then called the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the U.S., President Reagan raised the stakes in the arms race. The U.S. began spending $300 billion per year on defense and forced Russia to do the same if she wished to continue to compete with the U.S. At the time, the United States was a $3 trillion economy, but Russia was only about $900 billion. This means that Russia had to spend 33% of her national earnings on defense just to keep up with the U.S., and it didn't take long that by 1991, the Soviet Union was bankrupt and the Cold War was over. Currently, the U.S. spends about $550 billion on defense, and Russia in the recent past has not been able to compete. But this new oil well has caused all that to change, so much so that Russia has been described in buying armaments on the world's throughout the world as a kid in a candy store. She can't seem to get enough. And in recent months, she has restarted the Cold War, flying armed bombers over airspace in both Britain and the United States, causing both nations to scramble their fighters and intercept these large bombers. To aid her in rebuilding her military, she has now become the largest arms seller in the world. Curiously, the U.S. has made this possible by refusing to sell arms to certain states. Russia, with her new money for resources and her boom in building, has quickly stepped in to fill the void. Russia has recently completed two missile systems, one for the defense of Syria and one for the defense of Iran. These brand new systems were made available even before they were operational in Russia. So 15 years ago, Russia crumbled into military irrelevance due to a lack of funds, a mere $300 billion, about what she'll gain in oil alone this year. Now she is poised to have that amount of oil revenue, and she is also the world's leading producer in natural gas, along with other mining elements. And the continent of Europe is quite concerned. Now, why is all this important to us in a lecture about the signs of the times? It's because Russia, 2,600 years ago, when the prophecy of Ezekiel was named the king of the north who would advance against Israel in the beginning of the battles the world calls Armageddon. Ezekiel wrote in Ezekiel 38 and verse 1, "And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, I'm obviously left out some verses here. Here we have a bunch of nations which are apt to be quite unfamiliar to us all. Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. The term chief prince there is from the Hebrew word rosh, or ros. The translators of the King James Version translated the word rather than using the term as a proper noun. And as it turns out, all of these countries that are listed here in this chapter, our names are identified as countries in antiquity. Following the fall of the Tower of the Babel, as nations migrated across Europe, they settled by tribes in different regions. Ancient historians, such as Herodotus, have traced their movement and found these things. Magog and Gomer were dominant tribes as they moved across Europe, and they spread themselves out across the Danube and the river which splits Europe into northern and southern sections, the people of Magog settling to the north and the people of Gomer settling to the south. Rosh is the earliest known name of Russia. We first learn that the river through modern Kiev was called the River Ross. The following is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Russian Belaya Serkov, a city, Kiev's Oblast province, north central Ukraine, on the Ross River, founded in the 11th century. It long remained a minor regional center. In modern times, industry has developed, including machine building, tire production, etc. And the city has an agriculture institute. Further, the Encyclopedia Britannica says, Rus, also spelled Ross, is an ancient people who gave their name to the land of Russia. Their origin and identity are some very much in dispute. Traditional Western scholars believe them to be Scandinavian Vikings, an offshoot of the Varangians who moved southward from the Baltic coast and founded the first consolidated state among the Eastern Slavs, centering on Kiev. Russian scholars, along with some Westerners, considered the Rus to be an Eastern Slavic tribe that founded a tribal league, the Kievan state, and they affirm was the creation of the Slavs and was attacked and held only briefly by the Varangians. Russian scholars have insisted that the Eastern Slavs before the entry of the Varangians had evolved a sophisticated feudal state comparable to the Carolingian Empire of the West. The Rus were simply a southern Slavic tribe living on the Ross River. So there can be no question as to who these people named Ross were. Next, we go to Meshech. In the Hebrew, certain vowels are not placed in the words, which can make their translation difficult, especially as applied to proper names of an unknown origin. The word Meshech is translated from three letters, M, S, and C. In the same river region as the river Ross, there is another river, this one called the river Mosk, or Musk. According to the Times Atlas of World History, the river bore the name Musk until about 1020 AD, when it was changed to Mosca. It was upon this river that the Muscovites developed, and the river and city and region still bear the modern version of this name. The modern river is Moscow, the city is Moscow, and the region is Muscovy. In Hebrew, the spelling of Musk would be the same as the spelling for Meshech. The final nation mentioned there in conjunction with the king of the north was Tubal. This word is translated from the Hebrew letters T-O-B-L. Again, we see that in the region of Russia, there was a Tobol River in antiquity, which still bears the name Tobol, and a town, Tobolsky, exists on that river. So these three old names, Ross, Musk, and Tobol, then are all prominent rivers in Russia upon which a people developed. Identifying then the nations of Ezekiel 38 is no more difficult than researching the names in antiquity. Gog, king of the north, is the prince of the peoples of Russia. So what we see in the world today, what we see going on with these high energy prices, is the redevelopment of the nation of Russia, who is truly becoming a prince of the people and preparing herself to descend upon the land of Israel to take a spoil and to prey. And Russia is preparing a people for the future. In a recent Times Online article, the subject of Russian President Vladimir Putin's new textbooks were discussed. In this we learn, as Russia flexes its foreign policy muscles against the West and President Putin enjoys record approval ratings, the Kremlin is turning its attention to schools to instill a new sense of nationalism in children. Two new manuals for teachers have been accused of glossing over the horrors of the Soviet Union and of including propaganda to promote Mr. Putin's vision of a strong state. One of the social study teachers presents as fact Mr. Putin's view that the Soviet collapse was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. It describes the United States as being bent on creating a global empire and determined to isolate Russia from its neighbors. And again, from that same article, the book described Joseph Stalin as the most successful Soviet leader ever and dismisses the prison labor camps and mass purges as a necessary part of his drive to make the country great. The manuals are intended to serve as the basis for developing new textbooks in schools next year, though the Education Ministry officially insists that they would not be compulsory. Mr. Putin gave them a seal of approval at a conference he hosted for teachers at his presidential Dhaka last month. He described Stalin's Great Purge of 1937, in which 1.5 million people were imprisoned and 700,000 killed. He called it terrible, but in other countries, even worse things happened. Discounting the Soviet Union's long history of oppression, he said, "We had no other black pages, such as Nazism, for instance." Pavel Danilin, who wrote the chapter on sovereign democracy, told the Times that it explains the core transformation of Russia under Mr. Putin. "We understand that the only guarantee for our democracy is our sovereignty, our strong state, our strong army, our strong economy, and our strong nation," he said. "It is not ideology. It is just common sense. And my intention was to explain that common sense to teachers." So Russia is clearly setting herself up to take her divinely ordained position on the world stage, a position of antagonism towards Israel. But the prophet Zechariah had said, Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughters of Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. For behold, I will shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants. And he shall know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion. For lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto thee. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Here is the antagonism which brings the world into conflict with God. Whoever touches Zion, whoever touches Jerusalem, touches the apple of God's eyes. The Lord shall inherit Jerusalem, his portion in the Holy Land, and he shall choose Jerusalem again. Israel belongs to Jesus and the saints, and anyone who touches or fights over it or tries to claim it for their own will suffer for it. This is the case today, as we can see, and it has always been the case. 2,600 years ago, the first world empire, Babylon, a city which was located in what is now called Iraq, and its great general, King Nebuchadnezzar, had touched Jerusalem. They had 3 times destroyed the city. They had torn down the glorious temple built by King Solomon. They had carried away the Jews out of the land. They had destroyed the land. For their actions, this was prophesied by God through Jeremiah against Babylon by Jeremiah. We read there in the 50th chapter, "A sword is upon the Chaldeans, saith the Lord, and upon the inhabitants of Babylon, and upon her princes, and upon her wise men. A sword is upon the liars, and they shall dote. A sword is upon the mighty men, and they shall be dismayed. A sword is upon their horses, and upon their chariots, and upon all the mingled people that are in the midst of her. And they shall become as women. A sword is upon her treasures, and they shall be robbed. A drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up. For it is a land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols. Therefore, the wild beasts of the desert with the wild beasts of the islands shall dwell there, and the owls shall dwell therein. And it shall be no more inhabited forever, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation." In this prophecy, God makes it clear that he would destroy Babylon, and it would be no more inhabited. Now, this would be no simple act. Babylon was an incredibly strong and fortified city. It was one of the leading cities in antiquity. It was established on the mighty Euphrates River. How could this desolation prophesied in this chapter ever happen? After all, King Nebuchadnezzar himself had personally finished the walls that surrounded the city. This is what he himself wrote about the walls as found in the excavations of Babylon. in order to strengthen the defenses of Asagala, that the evil and the wicked might not oppress Babylon, that which no kind had done before me. At the outskirts of Babylon, to the east, I put about a great wall. Its moat I dug, and its inner moat wall with mortar and brick I raised the mountain high. About the sides of Babylon, great banks of earth I heaped up. Great floods of destroying waters, like the great waves of the sea, I made to flow about it. With a marsh I surrounded it. This was an incredible feat. Archaeologists have shown that the wall was not one wall, but a series of walls, surrounded by a water-filled moat 150 feet wide. There was an outer wall around that moat. Then a very thick wall, about 95 feet thick. Thick enough that four horse chariots could easily turn around on top of the wall. And there was yet another wall, an older wall, inside of that. The city was built over the river Euphrates. Concerning protecting the city from invasion, Nebuchadnezzar was found to again write the following. In order that no pillaging robber might enter into this water sewer, with bright iron bars I closed the entrance to the river. In gratings of iron I set it and fastened it with hinges. The defenses of Ensagla and Babylon I strengthened and secured for my reign an enduring name. The city had been made virtually impregnable by Nebuchadnezzar. So how could this prophecy of God through Jeremiah come true? In fact, the city was so well defensed with its walls and gates, and with the second great world power, the Medes and Persians, encamped outside the city preparing an attack, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, King Belshazzar, decided to throw a party. That is how strong and secure the defenses were believed to be, and how confident the Babylonians were in their walls and gates. But in one night, while Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, the then King Belshazzar, was giving a party, he commanded that the vessels which had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem, which his grandfather had sacked, be brought out and used to serve the guests. And while he drank of them, this happened as recorded in the prophet Daniel. In Daniel 5:5 we read, "In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote." And what that hand wrote was interpreted by Daniel, the prophet, to Belshazzar. "God hath found thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." On that very night, a great construction project that had been started by the Persian Cyrus was finished. This project diverted the water of the mighty Euphrates into a different course. The water no longer went through that city, but was diverted around the city. And the great iron gates built by Nebuchadnezzar no longer had the water for its floor. And the Medo-Persian army marched in on the riverbed under the gates and conquered that city. That was about the year 538 BC. 70 years later, the city of Babylon had a great civil war, and most of the city was destroyed. Babylon continued as a shadow of its own grandeur until about BC 275, when the city was all but vacated, and the remaining blocks of the city were removed to the Seleucia on the Tigris. And the last record of anyone living there in any kind of numbers was around 80 BC. So while this great city had been watered by the mighty Euphrates, now it was a city in the midst of a desert. Over time, the city withered and died, exactly as God prophesied. In fact, so complete was the destruction of Babylon that in the early 1800s, people who argued against the authenticity of the Bible, the people who argued that the Bible was a book of fables, used as proof the fact that Babylon couldn't possibly have existed, for if it had, surely some remnant would have surfaced by then. But in fact, that was just about to occur. Babylon was located by a British archaeologist named Layard in 1847 and eventually excavated in the very early 1900s, where remnants of the great city were unveiled. Babylon was not to be rebuilt. fact, Saddam Hussein had once set his eyes on rebuilding Babylon in defiance of the Jewish prophecies. And we can see how far that got him. What happened to Babylon is what happened to those who take up a position against Jerusalem and Judah, to those who touch the apple of God's eyes, as Zechariah says. God does not rest until they are destroyed. And what we see in the Middle East today, and the turmoil we see nearly daily over the city of Jerusalem, will not end until Jesus Christ returns to take the land for himself and his chosen saints. You see, God made a promise to a special man, Abraham. Abraham was a faithful, God-fearing man living in the area we would now call southern Iraq. God took Abraham and called him out of the darkness that was Iraq to the light, which was Israel. And once there, as he stood on the mountain in Israel, we read of the promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis 13. And the Lord said unto Abram, after the lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes from the place where thou art, northward and southward, eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. This promise made by God to Abraham that he and his seed would inherit this land, a promise which was repeated to his sons Isaac and Israel, became the hope that all Israel longed for. God didn't tell Abraham to look up, that he would inherit a kingdom in the skies. He didn't tell him to look down. He told him to look at the land of Israel. And God promised Abraham that he would inherit this land forever. But the promise wasn't just made to Abraham. It was made to Abraham and his seed. Commenting on this promise in his epistle to the Galatians, the Apostle Paul wrote in Galatians 3:16, now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. So the promise made to Abraham and to Christ became the cornerstone upon which all the rest of the world's events were to be built. We, living today, have the opportunity to become heirs of these same promises, heirs of the land of Israel through Christ. For Paul concluded his third chapter to the Galatians this way. In Galatians 3 at verse 27, for as many as you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. And if ye be Christ, then are ye Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. We, through baptism into Christ, can be heirs of that promise which God made to Abraham. This is our great hope. Remember Paul in chains for his belief standing before the Roman government? What did Paul tell them? In Acts 26:6, he said, and now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God night and day, day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. This is why Paul was in chains and why he was willing to endure them. Because he believed in the promise that God made to the fathers. He preached it. He was imprisoned for it. And ultimately, he died for it. This is the promise. This promise was what the 12 tribes of Israel were still waiting for in Paul's day. And those promises are not fulfilled. Writing to the Hebrews, the Apostle Paul wrote of these promises. In Hebrews 11, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. These all, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, received not the promise, but they were persuaded of them, and they did embrace them. And they remained only pilgrims in the land of Israel. And there was a reason for this. Paul concludes the chapter thus, "And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." When Russia comes down upon the mountains of Israel, as prophesied in Ezekiel 38, she comes with other nations besides herself and her nation. These are also all mentioned in that 38th chapter, and they are also identifiable just as Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal were. We have already talked a little bit about those. The names Magog, identifiable with with Germany, and Tubal with France. In Ezekiel 38, at verse 5, we read, "Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them," that is, with Russia, "all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and his bands, and the house of Togarma of the north quarters with all his bands, and many people with thee." Persia, of course, is the ancient name of modern Iran. They are also now closely allied with Russia, as is Libya and Ethiopia. Magog and Gomer are ancient names to which we are indebted for Herodotus for an explanation. As we said previously, he wrote that the peoples of Magog and Gomer migrated from what we would call Turkey across Europe, and the people of Magog settling north of the Danube, and the people of Gomer settling south of the Danube. So the Germanic people are the descendants of Magog, and the French the descendants of Gomer. We can see then why Russia is called the King of the North. All the nations which the Bible prophesy will come against Israel, come against that land promised to Christ and Abraham and the saints. And when they will come in an overflowing manner, as we read in Ezekiel 38 at verse 9, "Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods, that dwelt in the midst of the land." But when Russia and her allies advanced against Israel, she is met there by another group of nations set for the defense of Israel. Now, we don't mean that these nations are there to defend Israel for any love of Israel. They're there because of their own self-interests, their own interest being at stake. And this is what they're actually defending. In Ezekiel 38 at verse 13, we read, "Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil?" Now, Tarshish is the name of the nation which was the richest of the world's nations. It was the greatest naval power, the greatest trading nation, and a nation which the scripture says spreads its wings over Israel. Now, spreading wings is a scriptural expression meaning to take care of, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. And it is not hard to see this more literal today when the navies of the world carry so much air power on all their vessels. A book called Jane's, All the World's Fighting Vessels, which is a reference for the world's navies, said that each American aircraft carrier, for instance, is more powerful than any European air force except Russia. And currently, there are 5 such vessels surrounding Israel. That is, as of today. Tarshish and her young lions is a collective term for the English-speaking people who have taken a stand for the defense of Israel. From the Balfour Declaration giving the Jews a homeland under the British Protectorate, to the United Nations establishing Israel as a nation at the insistence of the United States, the English-speaking people have truly spread their wings over Israel. And it was obvious many years ago that this would be the case. Writing in The Ambassador for 1865, over 150 years ago, A Christadelphian writer, Robert Roberts, wrote, "The nations cooperate in this movement. Surely the isle shall wait for me. The ships of Tarshish first, by which there is reason to believe is meant the English and American marine, to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, under the name of the Lord thy God, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee." It is not too difficult for anyone today to see that. Since before the end of World War I, Russia has been the natural enemy of the U.S. and Britain. But it is the other nations which are mentioned which are of more particular interest in current events. If we think back to the start of the wars between the Western powers and the Islamic states, we remember that from the start, most of the Islamic nations were fairly united. All the major states were working in concert against Israel. Egypt, which was already beaten badly in two wars with Israel, was really the only outlier. The Iraqis did not have good relations with any of her neighbors, but they were united with their neighbors against Israel. But the prophecy we have just read indicates that some of the Arab states will be with Tarshish in defense of Israel, a thing almost unimaginable 10 years ago. These are the states who inhabit the area anciently known as Sheba and Dedan, or the Southern Arabian Peninsula. They are Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Jordan, and all the little countries along the Persian Gulf. The invasion of Kuwait by Iraq started the breakdown of this united Arab front. Saudi Arabia was concerned that Iraq might not stop with Kuwait, but continue down to conquer the oil-rich nation. She participated greatly with the United States in fighting Iraq, providing military bases for the United States to fight from. But when Gulf War I was over, the Arab states still pretty much went back to business as usual in a unified fashion and a hatred of Israel. But the hardline Arab Islamics couldn't stand the change in relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel and the West. So men like Osama bin Laden began to plot the overthrow of the Southern Arabian governments who had cooperated with the West. And this rest culminated with the Islamic attack on the United States on September 11th in New York City, as which we're all familiar. As all know, the United States ultimately invaded Iraq, further agitating Islamists in the region. And with Iraq nationally destroyed, a vacuum was created, which has been filled by Iran. And their growing power has further worried the nations of the Arabian Peninsula. In fact, it has so worried these states that shortly after high this year, that is, in the very late July of this year, we saw the United States announce an arms deal that under normal circumstances would have sent all the nations of that region into chaos. This is how the arms deal is related by some of the news agencies. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has praised Washington's decision to increase military assistance to Israel, even as other voices in Israel join criticism in the U.S. over plans to sell advanced weapons to Saudi Arabia. The U.S. media over the weekend reported that the Bush administration is set to ask Congress to approve an arms package to Saudi Arabia that would include satellite-guided smart bombs, upgrades to their Air Force fighters, and new naval vessels. The $20 billion package is reported to include weapon sales to other Gulf states, such as Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the UAR over a number of years. To offset concerns over the sales to the Saudis and the Gulf states, the administration is reportedly proposing $30.4 billion in military aid to Israel over the next decade, $9 billion more than the amount received over the past 10 years. And it goes on. A statement released by the Prime Minister's office quoted Olmert as saying that those moderate Arab states are at the forefront of the global struggle between the moderates and the extremists. Iranian-led Islamic fundamentalists threatens them as well, Omer said. And in the framework of their being strengthened, there is the commitment that the new weapons will not be used against Israel. This arms deal, applauded by both the governments of Israel and the collective governments of Sheba and Dedan, also includes Egypt, who is the original king of the south of Daniel 11, in setting a position against those northern Arab states. These nations are now so closely aligned that they no longer fear each other so much as they fear the northern Arab forces of Iran and Syria and her great new powerful ally, Russia. Which brings us up to that attack we've been reading of more and more as time goes on, which took place just a little bit less than a month ago. The Wall Street Journal, one of the few news agencies to report this story, says that Israel bombed a shipment of supplies necessary to build nuclear arms received from North Korea in Syria. The Western nations had all protested to North Korea about this shipment, and the North Koreans denied that this had anything to do with nuclear material. Stratfor.com, a private intelligence company located in Austin, Texas, reported that it was nuclear equipment that was received, some of them speculating that this was material to be used to restart the Iraqi nuclear program, which some at Stratfor believe was smuggled out of Iraq by Russia in a well-reported 30-truck caravan, which the United States permitted to leave Iraq and to go into Syria at the very start of the Gulf War. Why this is so interesting to us is that any time in the past that Israel has bombed an Arab neighbor, the Arab street exploded into protests, which brought missiles down on Israel and months of protests against Israel and the United States. This time, there was only silence. Only Turkey has launched a formal complaint against Israel, claiming Israel violated their airspace and dropped bombs harmlessly in the desert. The Syrians, the Iraqis, and the Iranians can't complain out loud about Israel bombing nuclear labs they claim not to have. And the southern Arab states are silent and happy that Israel has lowered the threats they feel from their supposed Islamic brethren. This event, coupled with the arming of the southern Arab states with Israel by the Tarshish powers, shows us just how close we are getting to seeing all the players in place for the return of Christ. Ezekiel 38, Ezekiel 38, 14 through 16 says, "Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog, thus saith the Lord God, in that day when my people Israel dwelleth safely, shalt thou not know it? And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts, thou and many people with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army. And thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me when I am sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes." These are the events that are drawing closer and closer each day. While men become more and more corrupt, God continues to work out his plan of salvation to purify the earth from the corruption around us. And the conclusion of the matter is this, is recorded in those last few verses of Ezekiel 38. "And it shall come to pass at that time, at the same time, when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come up in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field, and all creeping things that creep upon the earth, and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. And the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. And I will plead with him against him with pestilence and with blood. And I will rain upon him and upon his bands, and upon the many people that are with him, an overflowing rain and great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord." Yes, the armaments that the nations of Israel surrounds herself with will be of no avail when Russia and Europe and the northern Arab states advance against her. The nations set for her defense will be overrun, according to the scriptures. Israel's hope will be gone. And then, out of a small mustard seed-like army led by Christ with his saints, they will intervene into the world's affairs and deliver Israel and place Jesus, that righteous Son of David and Son of God, on David's throne in Jerusalem, from where ultimately he will rule the world in peace. And Zechariah 12:9 then shall come to pass. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations which come against Israel. And God, through Jesus and the army of his saints, will destroy them and give the land to Abraham and his seed. That is Jesus. And those of us who have become through baptism and obedience and faith, heirs of that wonderful age. May it be our lot that all that are sitting here may take these words seriously and prepare ourselves as we see the nations align themselves ready for these final days, which the world calls Armageddon, a battle which will not destroy the world, but will set Jesus on the throne in Jerusalem, reigning with his saints gloriously.